comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are and wherever you happen to be all around this gorgeous planet, thank you for being here at the show. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate that. I'm here because you have a right to know. I'm here because you matter. We're really privileged here at this show in that some of the very best possible guests come our way. And that's the case tonight. 12 years ago, when I first started this show, our guest tonight was already world famous and has been for a long, long time. His name is John Anthony West, and he'll be joining us in just a few minutes. If you have any interest at all in the mysteries of ancient Egypt and the mysteries of the Giza Plateau, the pyramid, what's it all about? What's up with that? Who built it? When was it built? And if you've done any study on that and you've come to the conclusion that the standard answers given by establishment Egyptologists, you come to the conclusion that those are not correct, well, then you know the name John Anthony West. And we're going to be talking about all of that tonight, and we're going to be talking about some exciting new discoveries of something very, very ancient, not in Egypt, but that pretty much screams that what he's been saying about Egypt, about these ancient sites in Egypt, is true. Let me remind you that we are 100% listener-supported. That means I'm not selling Coca-Cola, Ford, Chevrolets, or Energizer Bunnies here on the show. We don't play commercial spots. We play spots, but not commercial spots. And we're 100% listener-supported. If you like the kind of information we bring you night after night after night, then let me urge you to stand with us so that we can keep standing. And how do you do that? Well, go to my website. On the website, you'll see a little menu across the top, and it's one of the menu selections is Join. It's always free to listen, 100% free to listen to this show everywhere in the world. And we have people literally all over this world listening to this show right now. It's always free, but for only 25 cents a day, that comes out to $7.50 a month, you can join our members community. And what do you get if you join the members community? Well, we appreciate you standing with us. And so we think you ought to get something for standing with us and helping us to keep broadcasting. In the members community, you get to watch the show live every night. You get, and then that show is uploaded and is up there for the next 24 hours. So if you happen to miss it live, you can pick it up right then, you know, when it's convenient for you. You get your own blog page, your own friends page, your own photo album, your own video album, forums, chat room, video galaxy of videos to watch, and a whole lot more. Why don't you join and help us keep doing what we do night after night? We'll be back with John Anthony West right after this. And And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and we are privileged to have with us tonight as our guest, John Anthony West. Now, he has been with us before. This is not his first trip to the Kevin Smith Show. But anytime we can get John Anthony West as a guest on this show, we have to consider that we are privileged. And John, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. It is a privilege to have you back.
Well, I thank you, Kevin. I will do my best to live up to that introduction.
Well, it'll be no problem for you at all, I'm absolutely sure. You know, for years, we've been enjoying books that you've written, and we've been watching DVDs that you've produced. I particularly like the one where I can't even remember the name of the DVD, the title of it, but it's where you talk about the mystical background of all of this stuff in Egypt. And you explain things from the more from the mystical point of view and what they were seeing in it. And
that's probably the series, the Magical Egypt.
That's it.
Tour series, the eight episode series, right?
Yeah, that's it. I have really enjoyed that, and I think, you know, lots and lots of people have. But you kind of shook the world up, both you and Robert Schock, Dr. Schock. You pretty much shook the world up when you started saying that there was no way that the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid could date to just 2500 B.C., that it had to go back further. And then Dr. Schock showed up as a trained geologist and took a look at the Sphinx and said, you know what, John Anthony West is right about this, and this Sphinx dates back, I believe he said, to about 12,000 B.C., didn't he?
No, it's a bit more complicated than that. Initially, he took, as a scientist should, the most conservative position possible, and said that it had to be at least somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 B.C., basically twice as old as it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, as we've been working together, he's come more and more to my position, which is that it's incredibly old, extremely old, maybe as much as 36,000 years old, which has to do with the precession of the equinoxes. It's not a number cooked up out of my head. But anyway, it's a longer story than that, and I'll try to just to give a for those who don't know it, because it's been going on now for about 30 years. And Schock's been involved in it for 20 years. So a lot of people who are not as ancient as me, or as I, will maybe not know about this. But I'm the one who developed the theory, but it's not my initial observation. My Egyptology work is based upon the life work of the genius, the French genius with the unpronounceable name, R. A. Shpala de Lubitsch, who had 15 years in Egypt from 1937 to 52, developed what is called by both detractors and adherents the symbolist school of Egyptology, which sees a high sacred science where standard Egyptologists and archaeologists, the academic, or as I like to call it, the quackademic establishment, sees only a remarkably gifted superstition, or let's say genius primitivism. And it was Schwaller who, in this enormous body of work, in one of his ancillary books, was talking about the Egyptians' own belief. I mean, this is as though modern quackademics know more about Egyptian history than the Egyptians themselves. There are a couple of documents. One is a stone tablet, and and one is a stone tablet, and one is a fragmentary papyrus, where the Egyptians talk about their own civilization and talk about long reigns prior to dynastic Egypt. Dynastic Egypt starts, according to the standard dating, around 3500 BC. But these tablets, one tablet, one papyrus, talk about long periods of time, thousands and thousands of years, when Egypt is ruled first by what they call the gods themselves, the Netcheru, and then another long period where Egypt is ruled by semi-divine beings called the Shemsu Hor, the companions or the followers of Horus. And when you work out, they give the names of these rulers and their regnal periods, how long they reigned. And when you add that all up, the two don't coincide exactly because they're both fragmentary, but you get something like 36,000 years. And Schroller was writing a long chapter in one of his books, which, when I was doing this work, were initially not translated into English, so I had to learn French in order to get through them. And Schroller, at the end of this long chapter, where he's talking about the Egyptians' own belief, you don't know about this if you read standard books of Egyptology, or let's say books intended for the public, not just scholarly books. And so Schroller wrote this long chapter talking about the writers of antiquity, Greco-Roman writers of antiquity around the time of Jesus, and how they were quoting the Egyptian priests talking about that Egypt was much, much older. And then, almost out of the blue, he throws out the single line that is, oh, and of course, the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of aquatic erosion, in other words, water weathering. I'm translating literally from the French. And as soon as I read that, the penny dropped in the slot, and I said, a textual argument isn't science, but water weathering, that should be science. And I'm not a geologist, but that should be a question that a geologist could answer. So on the basis of that, and then that set me off on the long quest when I was writing my first book on Egypt called Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, which is an in-depth introduction to Schroller's own work. And Schroller is, like many great geniuses, he's not a great communicator. So Schroller is not easy to understand in French or in English now everything's translated. So I'm sort of his self-appointed Boswell, because I'm, as a writer by trade, I can make his very difficult work comprehensible to an intelligent audience, not to a stupid audience, but to an intelligent audience, yes. And so I realized that was the key, that if you could prove that the Sphinx had been water weathered, it would effectively destroy the whole notion, everything we've ever learned about ancient history, I mean very ancient history, because the Sphinx is unquestionably the most spectacular sculpture on Earth. And the temples around it initially don't look like that much. They're not gigantic temples like Luxor or Karnak, but they're built of blocks of stone that weigh 150, 75, 100, 150 tons, slotted into place like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. So in other words, if the Sphinx is much, much older than dynastic Egypt, it means not only are they not just hunter-gatherers living in those very distant times, it means that there's a civilization in place capable of producing the most spectacular sculpture on Earth and in possession of a technology to build temples that we, in fact, with all of our modern equipment, could not build today. We probably could if we wanted to, if it were important. If we can fly to the moon, we could probably figure out a way to manipulate 200-ton blocks of stone that slot into their place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. But at the moment, we can't actually do this. So I realized the importance of that one single observation by Schroller, and then set out to try to prove it. So, not being a geologist, I'd do my geological homework. And in the last chapter of Serpent in the Sky, I you know, I developed the theory and then tried to get people to look at the theory, but I'm not being a geologist, or in fact not having any academic Egyptological or archaeological letters after my name, it was very difficult. In fact, it was impossible to get anybody to even listen to me. And then finally, through another strange set of circumstances, Chuck and I are now right in the process of writing a book between us about this whole story of decoding the Sphinx. It should be a very interesting book. I'll maybe get a chance to talk about it as we go on. Maybe not, because time flies by in these things. Anyway, it took another 10 years to find Chuck, and then another couple of years to get him where, very cautious Chuck, and so he should be, finally agreeing to go to Egypt with me to take a look at this evidence, more time before he finally acknowledged and put his tenured neck on the block, which is not an easy thing to do. See, for me, it's easy to be a heretic. I don't have any credentials, and I don't give a damn what they think of me, since I disrespect both their intelligence and their integrity. I don't care what they say. But Chuck is an academic, and he's a tenured associate professor at Boston University of Geology. So it was a big move for him to do this. And then anyway, finally, he did. He said, yeah, you're right, this is water weathering, and there was this dispute. So there's still a debate, no longer a dispute, but a debate over the dating. And one thing led to another, and we gave our initial presentation, major presentation, at what is effectively the Super Bowl of geology. It's called the GSA, Geological Society of America's annual meeting. This was in 91 in San Diego, and that led, we were the big hit of the show. I mean, this set up a huge controversy, which has by no means died down, with the geologists almost, in fact then, 100% in favor of our evidence, saying, yeah, this is evidence, this is water weathering, and everything else follows from that. And the art and the geologists and the Egyptologists and the archaeologists absolutely incensed. I mean, rabid, hurling abuse at us.
So you have the geologists. You have the geologists that looked at this presentation, and they said, "Yep, that's right." And then the archaeologist and Egyptologist said, "That's nonsense."
That's right. That's right. And actually, I had a lot of fun with that. I got us both into a lot of trouble, but Chuck more than me, because I was interviewed. We were both interviewed as we were doing this presentation, because this was big news. It was all over the papers, scientific press, mainstream press, and the Chuck teaches Boston University, and the science correspondent from the Boston Globe interviewed Chuck first, and he did his thing, and then interviewed me, and he said to me, well, you know, what is this? Why is it? You know, here you are. The geologists all seem to be in agreement, but the Egyptologists and the archaeologists are all, you know, up in arms. Why is that? And my response was that this was a question. The entire theory was a question of water weathering, or of weathering patterns on rocks. And when it came to opinions on the weathering of rocks, and an Egyptologist's opinion and an archaeologist's opinion on this subject was no more valid than a proctologist's. And this got a lot of people very angry in the archaeological and the Egyptological community. And in fact, at that time, I had to promise Chuck not to make any more proctologist jokes, because it got him in a lot of trouble. And
well, you know, though, the truth is just the truth.
Well, yeah, the truth is just the truth, but getting the truth out there, this is another matter altogether. It isn't even science, because you got to get people to listen to the science, and then there's a whole big chunk of the procedure that is promotion, really, and advertising. I mean, all kinds of things play a part in establishing and busting the paradigm, as it were. It doesn't happen just on the basis of the evidence. Actually, Max Planck, the great 20th century physicist, had a well-known quote that I use in my book, In Serpent in the Sky, that knew I'll paraphrase, I don't have it exactly in my head, but that new ideas don't replace old ideas simply on the basis of the evidence. What happens is that the old guard, he doesn't use that language, but the paradigm, please, the keepers of the paradigm, eventually die out, and younger people who've grown up with the new idea and who don't have any vested interest in it eventually reestablish the new paradigm, which then, again, if that proves to be mistaken, have to go through the same process.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where we stand now, except now, after all of these years, I mean, it's my book is published in 79, and then it took another 11 years or so to find shock, and then we had this big thing, and then, of course, as you know, but maybe not everyone in the audience does, that the meeting at the GSA got us all of this publicity, and on the basis of that publicity, the object from the get-go was to do a documentary on it. We got NBC to do a special on it with Charlton Heston hosting it, and this was a huge success. Up until that time, one of the most successful documentaries ever shown. I won an Emmy for it, and the documentary itself was nominated for an Emmy. So this kept the whole pot boiling and the whole controversy going, and then it's been boiling on for all of these 20 years, with people taking pot shots at us and us responding, shocked scientifically, me satirically. I'm very good at this, by the way. And with us looking for a follow-up to Mystery of the Sphinx. And what we needed, we had loads more evidence. We've been building up the evidence over time. And in fact, in 2000, at Reno, Nevada, at another GSA meeting, we presented the further evidence, which is really very commanding, but it's not visually spectacular. And for whatever reason, this one didn't get much press. The other one got a huge amount of press, and this one not so much.
All right, we have to step away for break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes more with John Anthony West on the other side of this break. Ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to ancient Egypt, this is the guy. This is who you want to listen to. So you want to stay tuned for the entire show. Call your friends. Call your enemies. Get everybody on the show. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening is John Anthony West, and we are talking about really an amazing journey from the old paradigm about ancient Egypt to the new. And I had to sort of cut you off in mid-sentence because the break was taking over. Let me give you the mic, and the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Okay, I forget what the mid-sentence was.
That's quite all right. Well, I have a question before we get too far down the road here about something you mentioned earlier. And you were talking about there was one tablet and one papyri.
Yes.
That talk about these very, very ancient times, before pre-dynastic times, and that they go back to a time when the gods were ruling. And in person. And my question is, I know you know the theory that these ancients, when they talked about gods, were really talking about extraterrestrials who had come here. What How do you deal with that? What do you think about that?
I deal with that very swiftly. I think that's a bunch of nonsense, actually, because I don't necessarily dispute extraterrestrials at all. There's a ton of evidence out there. But the gods have to be understood not as technologically advanced beings, which is the theory that's been advanced by the late Zechariah Sitchin, whose followers I tend to call Sitchininis, because in fact when it comes to analyzing the ancient cosmologies, as it were, it's patently absurd. And if we had 3 or 4 minutes more than we have here, I would reduce it to its absurdity. But actually, the gods have to be understood, and this is not the fault of the Sitchininis necessarily, not as advanced technological beings, but rather as cosmic principles. You see, the Egyptologists themselves and the archaeologists, interestingly enough, there's a wonderful show at the Met right now called The Dawn of Egyptian Art, which is all about the pre-dynastic eras of Egyptian art, of Egypt, which are, let's say, dynastic Egypt starts somewhere around 3200 or so B.C., and these are the 2,000 years or so before that. And they've gone around and they've collected all of the art from these periods, which is not pyramids and temples, but small pieces, but many of them small pieces of such exquisite artistic quality that you have to realize that even if they're not building pyramids, these are advanced people. Primitives do not produce masterpieces of art. Anyway, I almost lost my thread.
Let me just ask this.
To the extraterrestrials. The gods have to be understood as cosmic principles. For example, what is a cosmic principle? Let's take the organic principles, which are fertilization, gestation, birth, growth, maturity, old age, death, renewal. Those are principles. And for each of those principles, Egypt had a so-called god, or actually an embodiment of those principles. And mythology is not a primitive attempt to explain the mysterious universe, but rather an extraordinary scientific, but at the same time, creative, dramatic capacity of explaining the interplay of those cosmic principles. In other words, it's a cosmology. It's a story of Genesis in the hands of the so-called gods. All ancient mythologies are cosmologies, as it were, and they are not primitive attempts to explain the universe. It's that the primitives are the people who invented the bobblehead doll and the hydrogen bomb, who are clever but primitive people who don't understand what the principles actually represent or how they manifested in these ancient times. And since I'm off on this rant, actually, the whole point of the importance of the Sphinx and the age of the Sphinx, and in fact, the importance of symbolist Egypt, is not just to, let's say, to put down, to discredit a reigning paradigm developed by quackademics who basically are people who are the emotionally retarded and the spiritually dyslexic. It's not really a question of discredit. It's a matter of understanding the alternative, which is what a real civilization is based upon. And all ancient civilizations, Egypt is just, to my mind, the most interesting because there's so much left of it, of a civilization where people actually knew, individually and collectively, what their lives were all about. You see, according to our Church of Progress, which is our operating paradigm now, we are accidental glitches in a meaningless universe. And the ancients saw it very, very differently. And the proof that the ancients saw it differently, and that their mythology and their symbology and, in fact, all of their architecture is a science, not just wonderful works by gifted primitives. That's the crux of the, of all of these decades of work that I've done. It's not really just a question of laughing at the quackademics. I mean, I personally have a lot of fun doing that, but that's not the objective. The objective is to demonstrate, as this whole goofball lunatic civilization is on the verge of collapse, that this is not the most advanced that civilization has ever been. There were much more advanced civilizations in the past, and the interesting thing of all of this work on Egypt is that it provides a model, or let's say a model not in the sense that we're going to recreate temples and mummify our presidents. I mean, most of them don't need mummification, they're dead already. We're not going to do that again, but the principles that governed or that motivated, the philosophy that motivated these wonderful ancient civilizations, those principles are eternal, and there's nothing, at least in principle, motivating or preventing us from recreating a civilization or civilizations based upon those same principles. That's the importance of it, not just that the Sphinx is so-and-so old, or that, you know, that the academics are wrong, or this, that, and the other. It's really a much more profound thing, and were it otherwise, I wouldn't do this. I'd go back to writing my satires and stories and plays and novels and screenplays, which is what I started out doing in the first place.
Okay, so if the gods are not actual persons that came here, as you've described, if that's not the case, who do you think built the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, and the Sphinx?
We don't know. We don't know, but I would say beings similar to ourselves, but with other capacities. And in fact, see, one of the interesting things about, I mean, even about what we now know, we don't know who built the Sphinx. We don't know who built the pyramids or how they built the pyramids. But this whole theory that I've been talking about all this time, we now have several smoking guns. You see, we have all of this evidence of water weathering and all of this kind of thing. But one of the things that's been preventing us from doing a follow-up video to the mystery of the Sphinx is that we didn't have a spectacular enough smoking gun to do another video of the same order, let's say, of our first one, that we could get to millions and millions of people, because we needed a hook, something spectacular that would back it up. And now we have it, and that is, I'm sure you know about it, this site in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. Do you know
about
it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've done several shows on that.
Okay, now this is what's for our purposes, what's so important about this is that it's the academic community itself that dates this extraordinary find. It was only found in 1996, I think, and they've been excavating it ever since. And everybody listening, if they're interested and they don't know about it, it's had fairly major press. It was a lead story in the National Geographic. I think it was May or June last year. It's had a fair number of stories, but still, it's basically, you might say it's under the radar in a sense. But you should Google up Göbekli Tepe, which is Göbekli, next word, Tepe. And this is a site in southern Turkey. And again, without going into a long explanation, it's a big hill, acres and acres of hill that's covered over, deliberately covered over, way back in the distant past. And when they uncover it, they find a whole bunch. So far, they've uncovered four of them. Stone circles like mini Stonehenges, but not so mini, with the central pillars, two central pillars weighing between 10 and 15 tons, intricately and beautifully carved in high relief. And there are another 18, radar tells them this, ground penetrating radar, there are another 18 or so stone circles that they still have to uncover over time. And they date this, they, not us, they date this to 10,000 BC or earlier. So this for us is the smoking gun, because one of the big arguments we've had to face from the archaeologists and the Egyptologists is that, oh, well, of course, even we don't care about the water weathering, even if all the geologists agree, and this is a geological argument, we know better because we're Egyptologists and archaeologists, and we're in charge of the paradigm. And it's impossible for these things to be, Sphinx and temples around it, to be as old as you guys say, because it's all hunter-gatherers back then. They didn't have any civilization, they didn't have any buildings, they didn't have any architecture, they didn't have any art to speak of. And then here's a site dated by the archaeologists themselves, by a good guy named Klaus Schmidt, who's the German archaeologist in charge of the dig, and he says that Göbekli Tepe is dated to 10,000 BC, or maybe even earlier. So that puts to sleep, that's the smoking gun, that destroys the argument that it's all hunter-gatherers back then. Not necessarily that they weren't hunter-gatherers, they were hunting and they were gathering, quite possibly, but in their spare time, they were sitting around lugging 15-ton blocks of stone uphill for a mile and setting them in place very intricately and carving them magnificently with no tools other than flint tools at their disposal. So this is the smoking gun for us. So now we're in the process of putting together, that's a long story, but we're busy putting together the package that allows us to do the follow-up to the mystery of the Sphinx. And this time we hope not to do it even on television. The last time, as I said, it was an NBC special. But we're hoping this time to do it as a theatrical release. And there's now, see, when we did this first one, that's 93, you didn't get documentaries in theaters, but now you can. Mm-hmm. Michael Moore's done it. A number of people have done it very, very successfully. So we have a spectacular story, and we're in the process of putting together the funding to actually do this. And now we have actually lots of other smoking guns. Only recently, a few weeks ago, I don't know if you know about this, but they found a bracelet, again in Turkey. Göbekli Tepe is in southern Turkey. A bracelet, just a bracelet made of obsidian. Now, obsidian is a volcanic glass, very, very difficult to work. And they date this obsidian bracelet to around 8,000 BC. And the scholars who have been studying it have remarked that the finish on this bracelet is so perfect that today we would need the most advanced polishing and finishing tools to produce anything as perfect as this. And at the same time, the geometry of the bracelet is extremely complex and sophisticated.
Well, we have to step away for break. We will pick up with the bracelet when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More with John Anthony West. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening, John Anthony West. And when we went away for break, you were telling us, John, about this obsidian bracelet that's been found. And I believe you were telling us that the experts that have looked at this have said it would be very, very difficult for us to create that bracelet today. Is that correct?
Not quite. We could do it, but it would take the most advanced technology we have to produce anything that perfect. So we could do it, but the fact that it's done, as far as we know, without any technology to speak of by people who are supposed to be hunter-gatherers, and that it employs sophisticated geometry. You see, even when they acknowledge that, they don't stop, the academics don't suddenly stop in their tracks and say, hey, guys, I guess we've had this all wrong for the last three centuries. Maybe we better reconsider everything we thought we knew, because that's what's actually involved in this. And pointing that out will be our task in our follow-up video that we're putting together. You know, we're putting together the plan and looking for the funding to get this thing out there. Yeah, this is a big deal, actually, that they could do this. I mean, this is not okay, let's say hunter-gatherers, and they come back home, and they, you know, and they say, well, guys, I guess we've, boy, we've, you know, we've got a rhinoceros here and a mastodon. That's enough food for a year. So what do we have to do? Well, we don't have any television yet, so let's get together and make an obsidian bracelet, even though this is one of the hardest stones in the world. And while we're at it, we're going to finish it to 1/10,000th of an inch tolerance. And we'll invent geometry while we're at it, too, because we don't have anything else to do. You see, you have to get...
Well, let me get your opinion on something.
Yes, I have lots of opinions.
Well, that's good. That's why we want you here. Okay, so look, you have said, as far as we know, they didn't have any of this high technology.
No.
Okay, but what about this theory that perhaps they in fact did have a type of high technology that we simply don't recognize when we see the remains of it? Because we're used to seeing machines and computers and things. And the example that I was given was 1,000 years from now, if somebody comes across a DVD, and this DVD has your series, The Magical Egypt. Okay, it's all there. But they don't know it. They don't know. They just see a shiny disc, and so they say, well, it must have been used in religious services of some kind.
100% agree, Kevin. Actually, I use exactly that argument on my Egypt trips. When we're standing outside one of the Sphinx temples, and I go into the question of the technology, and I'll do it as quickly as possible because I like being systematic about these things. There are four possibilities. One is that they had a genius command of very primitive technology that we don't understand. And you know, normally people will say, well, how is that possible? Well, as an analogy, if you put a violin in my hands, I will prove to you that you can't get music out of this device. But you put it in the hands of a violinist, he will get exquisite music out of the very same device. So it may be that somehow or another, they had the command of materials that, you know, with no metal and no machines or no anything, but they knew how to manipulate matter in some way that to us would be magic or inconceivable, and they could do it. The second possibility is that it's a kind of a technology that simply eluded our observation, and there's where your DVD example comes in. Somebody finds, I use the example of a computer. They find this 10,000 years from now, there's no electricity or anyway, not the same kind of electricity, and they say it's a religious device. Possibility, I don't particularly like that, that one. Actually, I prefer possibility one. And then possibility three is that it's done by people in a higher state of consciousness than ourselves who are summoning up capacities that are latent in us, but we can't normally access, but that they could access. And there are examples of that. The yogis can do things of that nature routinely, actually. There's evidence for that. Mm-hmm. And even people who are not yogis. A woman, you know, has a baby run over by a car and picks up the car to move it off the baby. She can't do that 5 minutes, 2 minutes before, and she can't do it 2 minutes after. But in certain... under certain circumstances of stress, people can do amazing things even today. So if you postulate the possible, you hold out the possibility that people could train those capacities, then they can do absolutely amazing things. And it's quite clear to me, you see, I like that possibility much better than aliens. The fourth explanation is, well, it's, we can't do it, therefore it has to be aliens. And I don't necessarily dismiss that, but I much prefer to think that it's people exactly just like us, but in control of certain capacities that are latent in us because they're proven. Some people have that, these to this day. Martial arts masters can do stuff that looks impossible, and they do it. I mean, you see that they do it. So I much prefer some combination of possibility one and possibility three to a hard technology like computers or something like that, or aliens, some combination thereof. And there's plenty of evidence that they had particularly now, I'm telling you, in the last year or so, so much stuff has come up, evidence of ancient knowledge, and some of it was there before, but now there's so much of it that you can put it together, you still don't understand it. But once you understand that they have different ways of knowing things, it's very, very clear from a lot of work, and we don't have another 3 hours to talk about this. By the way, we should mention, when I do my Egypt trips, because we haven't even mentioned those, much of my income, as it is, comes from doing these Egypt trips. And Egypt is, I always compare it, Egypt is like sex. People say, well, why is Egypt like sex? And the answer is that, well, you can read all about it, and that's interesting, and you look at pictures, that's even more interesting, maybe. But until you've experienced it, you don't understand it at all. And so with Egypt, you can read books from Nadeldum, they mine, Schroeder's, Lubitsch's, anybody's. You can go to the museums, well, that's really pretty interesting, but you don't see it in context. It's only when you're in Egypt itself, going through those temples, that you understand the difference between civilization and progress. Because what we have is a technological but diabolical progress. But yeah, it has certain advantages. I mean, I'd rather, even I, Luddite that I am, would rather go to a 21st century dentist than a 21st dynasty dentist. But by and large, they had a civilization. They knew what their lives were about. And we no longer, not only do we not know what our lives are about, we deny that they're about anything if we listen to the Church of Progress, the religion, or let's say Church of Progress dogma, which is that we're just accidental glitches in an accidental universe. Anyway, wait, how'd I get off on this tack? With our evidence, with all of the evidence and stuff. So, for example, they had a cosmology, a very intricate cosmology. Somebody you should, actually a good friend of mine, that you should have on your show one of these days, is a guy called, a man named, lives near here, called Laird Scranton, who's done very interesting books on the Dogon and Dogon cosmology. You should look him up, Laird Scranton, S-C-R-A-N-T-O-N, like the city. And things like, I mean, once you understand what you're looking for, you see it come up over and over again. For example, not too long ago, I was invited to be guest speaker for a retreat in southern Brazil that was an ayahuasca retreat of a couple of weeks of doing ayahuasca sessions. And I went through this, and this is not for the faint of heart. It's no fun. It's not a recreational drug, but it's very, very interesting. And one of the things that struck me was when the guy who was running the retreat was telling us about what ayahuasca it was involved in it. And it's two completely innocuous looking plants in the rainforest that don't even grow anywhere near each other, and there are 90,000, at least at the moment, 90,000 recognized different kinds of plants in the rainforest. And these two look like nothing. And it's only when they're combined in a certain way that they're effective, because one of them has the potent, I forget what it is, TCB or something, I don't know, the initials. Anyway, one of them has the hallucinogenic drug in it, which is a poison, and if you took it by itself, your body would immediately reject it. And the other plant fixes the poison so that you can take it and get this extraordinary experience, not very pleasant, but extraordinary experience from it. And in order to put these two plants together and make them work, it has to go through a very elaborate, several-stage process of boiling it in a certain kind of way.
We have to step away for break, but we will pick up right there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, more with John Anthony West right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And for those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. And my sympathy to you for whatever kept you away from the first hour. My guest this evening is John Anthony West, and we are talking about really some amazing information about ancient times and the remains of those ancient times and what they tell us. Particularly Egypt, but we've also talked a little bit about Göbekli Tepe, which, as you know, we have discussed on the show before. But John, you've been there, right?
Yes, I have. Yes.
And were you impressed with what you saw?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for us, you know, I mean, having fought this battle for me for, what, now? 1880. What's that? Yes, over 30 years in shock for 20 years and taking all of this abuse from all of these jackasses to have seen the whole thing vindicated by this amazing site dated by the archaeologists, not by us. And not even, you can bet that if there was any flaw to Schmidt's dating, his colleagues would be eating him up alive, because this destroys their entire paradigm. The whole thing has to be completely rethought from beginning to end. Actually, it had to be rethought from beginning to end on the basis of our Sphinx data, but because it was geology, they could avoid that and pretend that they were experts and that they actually knew what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But so Göbekli Tepe, that's the smoking gun, because there's no argument. Even they are not arguing. What they're not doing is recognizing the implications, which is that everything they ever thought about their whole discipline has to be rethought from the beginning, from the get-go.
And well, and earlier, you know, what it means is their PhDs are fiction.
Well, that's right. Well, yeah. They're not fictions, it's just that they're meaningless.
Yeah, well, okay, now I have a question about Egypt.
They worked to get their PhDs, but that what they were talking about was baloney, because the premises upon which those PhDs are based, the premises have now been basically rebutted and destroyed. But more important even than that, because this is just, as I mentioned earlier, this is a major quibbles between scholars. I'm a scholar. I mean, in this context, I'm a scholar. When I put my other hat on, my beret, then I'm a writer. But in this context, I'm a scholar. And so this is an argument, let's say this is a dispute between scholars. But there's much more at stake when you actually take into account the times that we live in, these are end times. We're forgetting for the moment, 2012 has gone into the literature, as it were, the Mayan calendar and the end times, and nobody knows what the Mayans actually signified. But what's clear is that even if you're aware of what's going on and you follow it, and I do because I work with my pal Gerald Celente on his Trends Journal, and so I keep abreast of this stuff. I never used to. When 9/11 happened, I said, this is really significant. I better watch what's going on in politics. And so I started to. Anyhow, these are end times. I don't mean that it's the end of the world necessarily, but the society, I hesitate to call it a civilization, but Western civilization, which is the model for everybody else in the world. I mean, none of the other countries have the wisdom to say we don't want your goddamn technology and your Walmarts and your McDonald's. We like it the way it was before, and we'll rather go hunting rhinoceroses and living in our grass huts than put up with the garbage that you people put up with. So it's Western society that's the model for the entire planet at the moment. And it's quite clear, it should be clear to everybody except maybe politicians and professors of political science, that this is a catastrophe. This is a lunatic asylum. And so our work is a demonstration that it doesn't have to be a lunatic asylum, and it wasn't a lunatic asylum in the past. And not only wasn't it a lunatic asylum, but it was also extraordinarily philosophically, spiritually, and scientifically advanced. So this is a big deal as far as we're concerned. I mean, when I read that one line, of Charlotte de Lubitz, that the Sphinx is weathered by water and not by wind and sand. I realized, and even Schmaler himself didn't realize, that he'd come up with the observation that could turn history around. His symbolist Egypt is magnificent. I mean, it's, in my view, the most spectacular work of scholarship of Western history, or ever, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's really, once you get into Schmaler, which is not easy, you realize what an extraordinary genius this man was. And as I said, I'm proud to be his spokesman, his Boswell, as it were. He died in the 60s, and anyway, he wasn't really a great communicator, as many really original minds are not. But I'm a communicator. That's my job. I'm a writer by trade. So this isn't just the chronology or putting down the, you know, making fun of the Egyptologists and archaeologists, which I hugely enjoy, I must say. I mean, that's, I won't
well, let's talk about that for just a minute. Let's talk about that for just a minute. In modern times, the guy who's been in charge of the kinds of things you study and research in Egypt was Zahi Hawass.
Zahi Hawass, yeah.
Zahi Hawass. And I think you know him, right? You've met
him.
Very
well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so he was in, then he was out, then he was in, and now he's out again. Who's in charge of this stuff now?
I don't know who the guy is who's in charge. He seems to be more or less of a bureaucrat. I don't count Zahi out. And as a matter of fact, this is a long story, which Shock and I will be telling in the book that we're working on now, that eventually we kind of buried the hatchet. And even though publicly he would be very nasty to the theory and to me, not necessarily to me personally, but to the whole theory and the whole idea that the Sphinx is much older and so on, but on a personal level, we actually got on reasonably well. And in fact, in a way, I'm sorry to see him go, because I could be sure if I needed permissions to do things, as long as I had, you know, as long as I was doing it according to the book, and I had the right kind of academic backup, I could get the permissions to do whatever I had to do. And with the new guy, I'm not sure. I suspect we'll be okay. Haven't met him yet, but my connections in Egypt are such that I can get to him without any difficulty at all. And I suspect, given the situation there at the moment, with all of this unrest going on and tourism way down, that anything that represents good publicity for Egypt or exciting publicity to Egypt is going to be okay. So I'm not really worried about it. But with Zahi, he's a very complicated character, and my sense of it always was, and we'll see if it works out, that he's not really an intellectual. He's a field archaeologist, really. That's what he really likes doing. And my sense of it always was that if the evidence were presented to him in just the right way, at just the right time, and he could afford to back up something that had, you know, that is opposed by basically the entire Egyptological and archaeological community, if he saw something in there to Egypt's benefit and to his own benefit, he would stand up and say so. I mean, he's a gutsy guy. So, in a way, I'm sorry to see Zahi go. And in another way, actually, one of the great things that Zahi did was that, and you don't know this unless you're deeply involved in, you know, in the whole study. Most people aren't. But for 200 years since Egyptology began, you could say that Egyptology as a discipline began with Napoleon going in there in whatever it was, 1804 or something like that. And since that time, Egyptology developed as a Western discipline, and there have been plenty of Egyptian Egyptologists who've been treated by the Westerners as a bunch of wogs, and I mean, really treated miserably, as though they're sort of subservient characters. But once Zahi got in, and Zahi's a very patriotic Egyptian character, once he took over, all of a sudden, the academics who ruled the roost now had to come to him for permission to dig up their Roman ruins or whatever kind of junk they were busy doing. And so now it didn't matter. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Oxford, Bonn, the Sorbonne, wherever they came from, they had to come crawling on their knees to Zahi to get permission to do their stuff. And lots of times they didn't get permission. And they were furious. And I loved this. I thought this was wonderful. Zahi totally justified his existence in my book by the way he treated these people who for two centuries had been treating his people as though they were a bunch of slaves. I thought that was great.
Oh yeah, I think so too. Let's take this call, and by the way, folks, the telephone lines are open. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
I forgot your guest name, but...
John West? John Anthony West. What?
John Anthony West.
Anthony West.
All right, John, I have a question for you.
Okay, hang on. Brent, you need to turn down your radio or computer or whatever you're listening to because we're hearing us back.
I don't have mine on. I have it muted.
Okay, well, I don't know why we're hearing us back, but go ahead.
Okay, would it be safe for us to assume, from a purely academic perspective, that a truly primitive society is one which assumes that just because it is currently at the top of the technological food chain, as it were, it is at the pinnacle of evolutionary standards? Conversely, would it be safe? Might we be allowed to assume that a truly advanced civilization is one which knows that no matter how technologically advanced it may become, there will always be something more advanced than they are?
Well. No, see, to me, that's in a way that's a non-question, because it means, what do you mean by advanced? You see, technologically advanced is one thing, and let's say spiritually advanced or philosophically advanced is quite another thing. So we are certainly more technologically advanced than, let's say, the American Indians that we murdered to get this country to ourselves. But from a spiritual point of view, they are much more advanced than ourselves. So you have to define, one of the few good things about contemporary philosophy is being able to define your terms, so you can't make those kind of assumptions. It's really where people are individually and collectively within themselves that determines what a civilization is. And if you want to really be able to judge a civilization, it's actually very easy. You don't even have to read history to do it. All you have to do is look at any society that you choose and see where they put their creative energy, because creative energy is actually the human manifestation of the divine. And so you look at us, where do we put our creative energy? Probably 60 or so, 70% goes into weapons of mass destruction or military. Another 30% goes into Disneyland and bobblehead dolls and crap like that. And maybe 10%, if that, I'm being generous, goes into real science and real medicine and technology that actually does some good. You look at Egypt, and this is a good paradigm, practically all of their energy, yes, they have their wars and things like that, but basically most of their energy went into art and architecture that had one purpose, which was to further the quest for immortality. And that's what makes Egypt important. I'm not trying to convert you into believing that there is such a thing as the immortality of the soul, but I happen to believe it. And that was the Egyptian belief. And as Matthew says, I think it's the book of Matthew in the Bible, by their fruits you shall know them. So you look at our fruits and you look at their fruits, and I leave the conclusion to you.
Our fruits are a bunch of nuts.
That's not bad.
That's not bad at all. Brent, thanks for the call. Good observation. All right, the telephone lines are open. John Anthony West is my guest, and if you have a question or a comment, please give us a call. It's 623-444-5889. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Jerome.
Hi. Mr. West, I understand your praise for Zahi Hirass in so much that he's making the academics go through him to get, you know, their results that they have. The thing that I don't understand is, from what I understand, you mentioned that he was open to new thought, but from my understanding...
Oh, I didn't say that at all. I didn't say that at all. I said that he might be if the evidence were ever presented to him at the right time in the right way. No, he's been absolutely not open to new thought any more than any of his colleagues are. But he might be. In other words, some of these guys will go down with the ship rather than acknowledge that rather than change their minds. And my sense of it with Zahi was that maybe he wouldn't. I can't prove that until it happens, but given that I know him and I know the situation, I've been working in this for 30 years, my opinion is that he might, whereas some of the others categorically will not. So that's a very conditional open to new thinking. Okay?
Mm-hmm. All right. I didn't mean to overspeak you.
No, that's all right.
I apologize for that. I thought that anything short of the Egyptians building the pyramids, he was not open to anything of that reasoning.
Well, he isn't, but neither am I. Whoever was in Egypt at that time built the pyramids, just not when he thinks they built them. And you see, even that's a very complicated question, because we, Shock and myself, are believe that the pyramids that are there at the moment, what we see, very likely they are built around 2500 BC, but demonstrably the evidence is there that they either replace or are superimposed upon structures that were there much earlier. So you see, there's a complexity there, and we can prove this. We presented this evidence at the Geological Society meeting back in 2000, and it's a very difficult argument to refute. But what you see there now is probably built when it's supposed to have been built. We're not sure, but it could be that they're older still, but there are older parts to the pyramid, undoubtedly, and we think that, and even the academics agree that the whole plan of the Giza Plateau is a very complex plan that's behind the whole thing with all of those different pyramids, that it was one plan to begin with, not one pharaoh saying, well, I'm going to put my pyramid here, and the other one saying, well, I'll line mine up that way, and another one saying, well, I don't like mine lined up that way, I'm going to push mine off a little bit to the side here. So even they acknowledge that it's one plan, and since the Sphinx is... You know, we'll happily put our necks on the block in support of the much greater antiquity of the Sphinx. So the Sphinx is much older, so is the other stuff much older, except that it's been replaced or superimposed upon because so many thousands of years have gone by and the other things were basically ruinous. But this is, lots more study has to go into this.
Mm.
Okay?
Thank you, Mr. West, for being on.
Okay.
And I just want to say that I believe in the immortality of the soul also.
Thank you. So do I.
Thanks for the call. All right. If you have a question or a comment, then please feel free to give us a call, 623-444-5889. If you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada, we understand that long distance, international long distance, can be expensive. And so we have an additional option for you, and that is just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and Scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and right above that picture you'll see a link that says Flash Message. But if you're in Canada or the USA, please use the telephone. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hello, Steve.
Hey, this is an incredible honor for me to be able to speak to two of my favorite iconoclasts, John Anthony West and Kevin Smith. You know, I got to be careful as I walk around here. I'm going to trip over some sacred cows that have been tipped over through the several years of all your work, Mr. West. I want to thank you for helping to introduce to our consciousness a larger pattern of not only history but consciousness that we can place ourselves within. You know, years ago when all I knew was our current culture, you know, it made me crazy. You know, it was an insane thing. But as I have been exploring and I have encountered your work and the work of other very mentally, spiritually heroic people, truly heroic people like yourself and your colleagues, it has restored my sanity, I think. At least I'm able to fit myself in a broader context of everything that's gone on, and opened so many doors of awareness. And I just want to thank you for that. First of all,
you're very welcome. But I went through the same process, and practically all of us have, except that I was lucky in that I knew that I was being brought up in a lunatic asylum at a very early age, 13 or 14 even. And that's a long time ago.
It truly is. The crazies are running the asylum. There's no question about it.
And the lunatic, the worst.
Something. I know James Horak, who is another brilliant gentleman who has been on the Kevin Smith
insane. Sorry, the criminally insane are in charge of the asylum. This is the problem. And my own path was very similar. I mean, to me, it was a couple of pieces of music, Beethoven's late quartets and the Monteverdi Vespers of 1610. And as a really very young, I was in the army in Germany and on furlough went, traveling around France and got into the Cathedral of Chartres. This is 1954, I guess. And it just blew my mind. I realized that everything I'd been taught, however horrible however insane the institutionalized church was, this was a work of divine inspiration. And it took a few more years before I actually started looking seriously into it, but those things set me on my path. So you're following really a standard path. That's how most of us figured out how to get out of this crazy house.
All right, we have to step away for break. And Steve, if you'll hang on, we'll take you first up after the break. We'll be back right after this.
Listening to the Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, John Anthony West. We have Steve on the telephone, and we have a flash message up from New Zealand. So, Steve, did you have another question or comment for our guest?
Well, I just wanted to reflect back on when Mr. West was talking about the alternative theories on the technology that created Göbekli Tepe and consequently the Sphinx and pyramids and so on, because mm-hmm. they share the same antiquity. Your third theory that human consciousness is capable of such feats, you know, just raw consciousness. And I want to echo that and tell you that I too believe that there's an immense power trapped in human consciousness that through neuro-linguistic programming and the so-called education system that we have today, which isn't education at all, that we have been programmed away from these areas in our mind that are capable of incredible things. And our task is to get ourselves free of that somehow and move into those areas. But it has to be done. You know, each individual has to make that journey himself, I suppose. But I wanted to echo that and reinforce that with you, Mr. West.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Why is this? Whoops, what's going on? I'm what is that? What? Is that better?
That's better.
Oh, see, I was getting strange voices back. Anyway, yeah, Steve, you're 100% correct, except that I say that the line in one of my books is that education is to the mind what AIDS is to the immune system. The more contact you have with it, the more likely it is to be fatal. And the whole idea is to extract ourselves from the rubbish that we've had drummed into us. But in order to be able to do that, first we have to be able to recognize, as you have, that what we've been taught is a bunch of baloney and deadly, poisonous baloney, and extract ourselves from that. Well, this is not easily done. And yet, unless it's done on a fairly large scale, those of us, I mean, Kevin's show here, I'm on a show with, you know, has a pretty substantial listener, you know, it has a pretty substantial audience, but it's not the American Idol audience or Jersey Shore. So getting the word out there and making these things understood and their importance understood is a prodigious task. And the wonderful Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, once one of his stories finishes with the line, "A gentleman only fights for lost causes." And I love that line because all you can do is fight for the cause, but It's a tough battle. My own conviction is that sooner or later, I won't even say it's a conviction, this thing is coming apart at the seams. Whether or not enough people will be around, aware enough to turn it around and actually establish a civilization based upon the same principles as the genuine civilizations in the past, this is not a given. A lot of new agers believe, you know, suddenly the clock is going to strike Aquarius and we're all going to be brothers and enlightened. I'm not so sure. In fact, I don't think so.
All right, let's take a look at this flash message that's come in from New Zealand. This is Mark in New Zealand. Now, this is pretty long. Mark, I'm going to have to summarize some of this. Just because of time. Okay, Mark says, "Who built the pyramids?" With all due respect to your guest, he is incorrect when he says that it is not known who built the pyramids. He says the builders were the Netaru, also translated as Neferu and Netheru. The ancient Egyptians were very specific in also identifying that these gods were indeed physical beings and that they came from a planet of the same name, Neferu. The ancient texts also provide us with a location of this planet, Neferu. It's 180 degrees out of phase, but on the same orbital path as Earth. The ancient texts also say the Neferu can be found in Tuat. A. E. Wallace Budge defines Tuat as everlasting and hidden. He goes on to say that Neferu is the same as Nibiru. And if you wish to find the location of modern-day descendants of the Neferu, you should go to the Netherlands. Mark.
I'll try to be polite.
That might be difficult for you, John.
Yeah, yes. There are no such texts. The Egyptians, the Netzeru, pronunciations, we don't know, Netzeru, are the so-called gods who translate just fine as cosmic principles. There is absolutely no evidence, none, that they are physical beings. And in fact, the notion that they're physical beings, I suspect that this, whoever this, I forget the name, Mark, is a Zechariah Sitchin fan, or in other words, a Sitchinini. There is zero evidence that for such beings being actually physical beings, there is zero evidence for the builders of the pyramids. I mean, we just plain don't know. And the rest of it, I mean, it's really, honestly, Kevin, I just as soon not spend more time going into the details of this, because it's up to Mark to provide the references that substantiate what he's saying, because let's say it's totally out of, it's contradicted by my 40 years of research.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just leave it at that. It doesn't mean that my 40 years of research is right. It just means that it's up to him to provide the evidence, and there's no time for that now, but I'm
okay. Well, he does mention the writings of A.E. Wallace Budge. Are you familiar with A.E. Wallace Budge?
Me?
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, mm-hmm. Naturally.
So what do you think about Budge?
Oh, Budge is actually, he's out of favor in Egyptology, which is by itself a reason to take him seriously. Budge has to be reconsidered, actually. I mean, he was working, you know, this is over 100 years ago, but he actually had more of a sense of what Egypt was all about without, I mean, Schwaller wasn't around in those days. He had more of a sense of what Egypt was all about than a lot of his detractors nowadays. And in fact, you want to read, actually, as you get on the program, Laird Scranton, who uses Budge's translations when he's going making his comparisons between the Dogon cosmology and the Egyptian, using Budge's translations, because they're, the words are the same, used by the Dogon and used by the Egyptians, by the ancient Egyptians. Anyway, complicated subject. But given the time that he was working in, Budge was, had a lot going for him, and when you realize what a body of work he put in over a lifetime, he's a pretty extraordinary character. Doesn't mean that he was less wrong than a lot of his colleagues, put it that way.
I cannot remember the name of the book, but I can remember the subject. One of his books is about the mummies, the Egyptian mummies. And
I don't know. Yeah.
Have you read that one?
No, I don't know that one.
You know, he was very wordy.
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought there would have been enough to say about mummies and the process and what it was all about. I wouldn't have thought there was enough to say about that to make a book that would be more than half an inch thick. But this thing's about an inch and a half thick. He's very, very wordy about it, but very, very detailed in explaining his observations and explaining his concepts. And it's been a while since I read that, but I do remember that he went into explaining what he thought this whole thing about having mummies was all about, that it was not just embalming.
What did he say? Because I don't know that book. Do you remember, Kevin? No, this
I really don't.
A lot, because go ahead.
Yeah, it had something to do with, you know, the concept of that life is not over when we think it's over.
Right.
And
well, that certainly, yes.
Yeah, and there was something he dealt in detail with the concept of ka.
The ka.
Yeah. But honestly, I don't remember more details, but I do remember that it was a chore to read the book because he was very, very wordy.
Anyway, well, let me, because that's interesting. I didn't know that about Budge, about that book. But as I was saying, he was more perceptive than a lot of his colleagues. And to this day, I think one of the reasons that they badmouth him is because he was actually, without being, let's say, a trained mystic, not that you can even be a trained mystic, but without being, let's say, formally associated with an esoteric tradition, he was into it. And actually, let me tell you, the one thing that I've heard about the mummies that makes sense of that otherwise rather repellent process to spend all of that time and effort to mummify a dead body, and it comes from that remarkable guy, Manly Palmer Hall, who said, and as soon as he said this, you know, if you're in my trade, as it were, you read things sometimes, well, a scholar's one thing, evidence, and then sometimes it's intuitive. Somebody says something and you say, oh yeah, that has to be right. So Manly Palmer Hall somewhere said that the purpose of this incredible amount of trouble that they went to mummify a dead body, and again, backtrack a bit, my sense of it is generally, it's not that the Egyptians were flawless and gods of themselves or whatever, but there was always a good reason for doing what they did, and then it got corrupted later on somewhere along the line. But according to Manly Hall, the Egyptians believed, my sense of it would be that they understood rather than just believed, that they knew that if, as long as the physical body remained physical, the disembodied soul, or ka, was not obliged to reincarnate, but could continue with its spiritual work at its leisure, as it were. So the process of mummification, 72 days to prepare to buy all of this stuff, there was something really repellent about this. And actually, when I read that of Manly Hall's, I said, yeah, that explains both why it's repellent. In other words, it's sort of a spiritual dodge. You're supposed to do this in your lifetime, actually. This is another big topic.
All right, we have to step away from break, John. We'll be back here in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, more when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. We just have a few minutes left in tonight's show. My guest this evening is John Anthony West. And, John, since we just have a few minutes left, I wonder if I can bump us ahead to something I've been wanting to ask you about.
Yeah, sure. Actually, can I just say one thing quick, because we're on the subject of mummification, that according to Manly Hall, the purpose of all of this incredible elaborate preparation was that as long as the mummified body, as long as the physical body existed, the soul of the deceased was not obliged to reincarnate. In other words, could carry on at its leisure its own spiritual work, which is kind of a spiritual dodge. And when I read that, I said, that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. That's otherwise why go to all that trouble? So whether or not that's true, whether or not that's the case, I don't know. But anyway, I want to get that in. All right, go ahead. Back to you.
All right. Several years ago, a couple of years, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, while Hawass was still in charge, they began construction of and have constructed now a wall around the Giza Plateau. there have been all kinds of stories about, you know, it's guarded by military and so forth. What's all that about?
Well, what I think it's about is about a lot of people who don't know what the hell they're talking about, looking for conspiracies and all of that sort of thing. I don't think it's about anything. In fact, I mean, the wall is a pain in the neck, and it's a very ugly wall. Zahi says that it's an order, that it's to keep out, you know, terrorists or something like that. This is not necessarily even stupid, because, you know, if you're looking to make trouble and you want to destroy the tourist industry, what better to do than blow up or, you know, or set loose a bomb somewhere in there? Not that, I mean, it would be easy to do anyhow, because the wall is useless. I mean, just to give you an idea of how useless the wall is, I sometimes go horseback riding when I'm in Egypt. And a couple of months after the wall went up, I went to the stable where I get a horse, and we went out, and I said, well, what are we going to do? Because the wall is up now. We can't get onto the plateau. And the guys laughed at me and said, we'll get onto the plateau. And I went a few hundred yards along the wall, and the horse drive guys had sort of broken a hole in the wall so that the horses could get through and you could go galloping along on the plateau. So it's just a waste of time, and it's hideous and it's stupid, but I don't think it's there for any particular nefarious purpose, because, I mean, people are there all the time. The tourists can go in. What are they going to hide? And there's all of these things about they're hiding this and they're hiding that. And actually, knowing Zahi as well as I do know him, which is not that well, I mean, you know, we're not brothers, but I know him pretty well. If something really spectacular came up and it was in his interest to not conceal it, in other words, and Zahi's a very patriotic Egyptian, you know, in other words, if it's good for Egypt, he's all for it, up to a point. And if something came up that was really spectacular, that contradicted his beliefs or what he's been brought up with, my sense of it is that he would publicize it, because one, it would be great publicity for him, that's first and foremost. Two, it would be great publicity for Egypt, and it would bring lots of people there, and he would do that, I think, but we don't know. Anyhow, I don't believe that they're hiding things, that they're doing secret excavations or any of that sort of stuff, because it's difficult to keep such excavations secret. It's out in the open. It's all over the place.
Very quickly, I've got a flash message from Deborah in the UK, and she wants to know if followers of Sitchin are Sitchininis or followers of Westininis.
Well, linguistically, it doesn't work very well that way, does it?
I think she's making a point, but anyway,
well,
look here.
Too.
Yeah, well, you know, and here's the thing, folks. Everybody,
Sitchininis is funny, and Westininis is stupid.
Yeah. Well, here's the point, folks. Everyone who looks at, I mean, everybody looks at the same evidence. Let me restate that. Everyone who looks at the same evidence is not going to come away from that evidence or from that data with the same opinion about what it's saying. And so what you're hearing tonight is what John Anthony West thinks about the evidence that he's looked at and what it says to him. And this is based on how many years now? 30 years of...
You know, 40 years, but it really doesn't matter how many years, because the Egyptologists have put in two centuries of work, and when it comes to interpreting, the facts may be correct, but the interpretation is ludicrous in view of the facts. And one of the interesting things about the work I've been doing, and Schwaller and Schock and all of us, even including, Sitchin really... I regard Sitchin as actually abhorrent, a repellent. I mean, his philosophy that the gods are aliens who made slaves out of the primitive human beings at the time is to me so absolutely repellent that it's even worse than the worst of the quackademics. So I have less than no regard for Sitchin, his work, or his followers. But
why,
anyway,
why don't you say what you really think, John?
Well, I was being gentle. And you told me not to use language that could get us in trouble.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
You did say that. You made that very quite clear. Because normally I would use stronger language, perhaps. Anyway. Yes.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. You have a website, right?
Yes, of course I've got a website. JAWest.com. And actually, we got so sidetracked, but I want to tell people that, you know, that I do my Egypt trips, and that I mentioned it before, and that in order to understand what this is really all about, you can read from Natal Doomsday, but if you have the wherewithal and the interest and the time, you go to Egypt with me, and there's no other way to do it. And in fact, there are only a handful of people who know Schwaller's work well enough to retransmit it, and it just so happens that I'm the only one who actually does trips. Most of the other stuff is either quackademic Egyptology, which is worthless, or well-meaning, new-agey kind of stuff that is okay in its own right, more touchy-feely than I like, perhaps, but it doesn't have the intellectual and the philosophical rigor that Schwaller has and that I transmit. So I'm a one-man show, as it were. And, you know, as long as Egypt, until or unless it dissolves into civil war, which could happen, at the moment it's still okay. Don't believe the rubbish that you read in the newspapers. It's not that it's a lie, it's that it's only one aspect of the picture. In other words, Egypt is a country of 83 million people. If under the worst circumstances, which has happened in the revolution, I was there for the entire revolution, go to my blog, Phoenix Fire, JAWest.com, and click on Phoenix Fire blogs, and go to the last one. I was there for the whole revolution. Under the worst circumstances, there were 1 million people protesting in the streets. But that means that there were 82 million people who weren't. So all you have to do is not be in those streets. And the mainstream press, I call them the prestitutes, are largely responsible, or at least in part responsible, for the economic problems that Egypt is having at the moment, because all they have to do is say, okay, this is the unrest. For the rest, Egypt continues as usual. Now, the upside of this, for anybody wanting to go to Egypt, is that there's
10 seconds, John.
Lots and lots of people away. What?
10 seconds. Okay, look, we're going to have to bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, John Anthony West, as always, it is very, very, very interesting, and for some of you, controversial. Hey, that's what this show's about. If things are not controversial, why would we want to talk about it? John, stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it. That's a wrap. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.